When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind a beautiful game and says that in the old days they didn't show a league table until after at least five games. I'm Kevin Day, he's Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. No doubt you're all pleased with yourself and your fancy 6 points, are you?
Yes, I'm already looking at European dates for 2022-23. Just renewed my passport and all systems go.
Yeah, you know, the worst thing about
10 days.
Yeah, the worst thing about being at Sellers Park yesterday was it was like watching Brighton. It was like, oh, a centre-back's passed to our centre-back. That's nice. What's he going to do with it? Oh, he's passed it back to the centre-back. He's passed it to the full-back. Oh, he's passed it to Wilf Sahar. What's he going to do? Oh, he's passed it back to the centre-back. A lot of passing going. Roy Hodgson would have been sitting there going, hang on, you would have been booing me by now. What's going on? It's questions day, Kieran, but we do have one important news story, and it's happened very quickly because we only spoke about it on Thursday. The hostile takeover of Rochdale has collapsed. What do we know about that, Kieran?
Yes, a collection of events effectively took place on Friday. We'd actually been contacted by the Rochdale Supporters Trust on Thursday with a view to getting them to come on the show to expand upon how they perceive the issues to be and their reservations about the rationale behind these new guys coming in to potentially own the club. Got to give credit to the EFL as well. They've not been rolling over, that they've stood up and they wanted to make sure that the correct tests had been applied, and there were issues. You know, I was getting quite a few messages coming through with regards to the background of the owners, some concerns that there were accusations made by the trust about comments that were made. And then things started to accelerate on Friday, where the EFL brought out a statement which effectively says that the prospective owners have withdrawn their offer. And they did own around about 42% of the shares. There were one or two kingmakers remaining. And on the back of that, it looks as if they are going to go through the process of returning or selling the existing shares that they have. Now, whether they're going to be sold to one party or offered back to the original owners, as yet we don't know what that's going to be. The EFL were investigating. I don't think there was necessarily a good relationship between the EFL and the prospective new owners in terms of getting information out of them, which appeared to be dragging things on a bit further. Rochdale continues to be a broadly owned club with lots of shareholders. There was no desire from the boardroom or the fan base for the club to be sold, and it looks as if that those fans have succeeded. And I think that's probably the best thing for all concerned, because why move into a house where the neighbours hate you?
Yeah, and you're fairly sure that it was the level and the vehemence of the fan opposition that led to the withdrawal of the attempt to purchase the club?
It was a contributory factor. I think the prospective owners were finding it increasingly difficult to buy more shares, right, which would have allowed them to get through the 50% threshold. And therefore, they probably thought, what's the point of being a significant minority shareholder at a football club where nobody wants us to be there, and had their offer succeeded, I think things would have ramped up a further level, because there's no doubt there's been communication between the Rochdale Supporters Trust and those of other clubs. And you know, I'm always in favour of non-violent direct action to move the dial. We've seen that happen at Swindon, at Blackpool, at my club, you know, and others historically. And if you do the things the right way, you can A, get really positive publicity and feedback, and B, keep the story in the domain whilst potentially damaging those who might not be on the side of the angels, we should say.
It's an indication of how far the Maguire family have come that you're in favour of non-violent direct action. As we know, many of your antecedents were very much in favour of the violent direct action approach, which could be just as effective in its own way. This is a triumph for Rochdale fans, and we applaud that, we salute it. But the only slight worry, and we did discuss this on Thursday, Kieran, when we talked about this story at some length, is that the potential new owners, the people who were attempting the hostile takeover, are still very adamant that this was the club's last chance to avoid financial doomsday, basically, that the club as it's being run is in serious trouble and they were the only way out. And that's still the worry in the back of my mind, that might be true, might be sour grapes, you don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've got Rochdale's accounts going back to year dot, as you can imagine. And like many clubs in the lower divisions, they find it tough. But there's no evidence that there were any pressing demands on the club. And I think some of the accusations by the prospective owners that of doomsday were perhaps a bit overstated. So I think Rochdale fans, you know, they've got a right to feel relieved and happy. It's still their club, you know, in terms of the way that they perceive Rochdale Football Club to be. But they're not out of the woods in the sense that, you know, we're still coming out of a global pandemic. The club has, like all clubs in a similar position, they've been living from hand to mouth for a long period of time, and they've got to cut their cloth accordingly. But provided they do take that approach, then there's no reason why they should be deemed to be worse off than other clubs in the lower two divisions.
Well, that's good to hear. And it's also, I think, important to note for any new listeners we might have that the future of clubs like Rochdale is just as important to this pod as clubs like Barcelona, and we will discuss as much time discussing one as the other. Basically, it doesn't matter how large or small a football club is, we are concerned about it and about their fans. And we have some interesting questions from fans, Kieran. Very interesting. Are you shaving while we're doing the pod?
I was just scratching.
Oh, okay, very well. Because I was just slightly worried. And in the old days, I'd be asking if you were manscaping while we were doing the pod.
that is taking multitasking to a new level.
I know it's the Baroness's birthday, so she'll still be in bed, I imagine. But I had visions of Finley putting lava on. He's a clever dog, lathering your face up and just giving you the... Anyway, our first question comes from Nick Berg. Hello, Nick. Nick Berg says, do football clubs have collective purchasing consortia for common items like beer, pies, sandwiches, seats, printing, etc.? Surely small clubs could benefit through having collected negotiated prices and larger shares of contract value and concentrated billing.
I think this is certainly something that's worth investigating by clubs. I think the downside of this is because we do have promotion and relegation, we've got clubs, you know, moving from the EFL to the National League, moving from the Championship to the Premier League and vice versa. And those are, of course, independent entities. There are collective contracts organised by the football authorities in terms of revenue generation. So, you know, TV, general sponsorship. Clearly, we've got the Sky Bet EFL, and you know, we've had the Vanarama National League, and so on, where the responsibility for those is delegated to the leagues themselves. I've not heard anything about clubs coming together. I think there's a slight element of the clubs might fear that they would be giving away sensitive information by doing so. So, you know, how, you know, if Club A is selling 30% yeah, more pies than Club B, and yet is getting the same average attendances, you know, is that a good sign? Is that a bad sign? And there are reservations. You know, the clubs are competing against each other, and anything which gives one a marginal gain against another would be viewed with a degree of skepticism and caution. So I think it's a really good idea from Nick, you know, for four or five, especially if you've got four or five clubs which geographically aren't too far apart, you know, why not all approach the local pie manufacturer and say, you know, three of us are using you, we will guarantee all four or five of us for the next 4 or 5 years if we can negotiate better prices, which either A, could be passed on to the consumer, unlikely, mm-hmm. or B, could help the clubs in terms of their bottom line. And, you know, in respect of the story that we've just dealt with in terms of Rochdale, every penny really counts more than ever.
Yeah, and talking of ticketing, as we sort of were, I have to mention, Kieran, one hero at Sellers Park yesterday, because Palace, at very short notice, literally less than 2 weeks' notice, decided to introduce an electronic ticket situation. And every Palace fan, having experience of Palace trying to do things like this in the past, panicked and basically got there at 1:30. It was still chaos around most parts of the ground. But Turnstile 4, the Arthur Waite stand, there's a young man on the gate, the steward, who was just fantastic. He was superhero. He was just literally, as people were approaching in the queue, just saying, "Give me a phone, give me a ticket, give me a phone." And he was doing it for everybody.
Brilliant.
And he was brilliant, because every other turnstile just had thousands of confused Palace fans going, "I've got an email. Look, it says here, it's got a barcode. It's not working, mate. Go to the ticket office." That's the queue for the ticket office. It's joining in with it. But yeah, so if you're the young man at Turnstile 4 or the Arthur Waite stand yesterday, congratulations. You deserve way more than the 12 quid now you're getting, probably. Our next question comes from Gaurav Singhvi. And Gaurav says, when the Lionesses or Young Lions play their qualifying fixtures for World European tournaments in various stadia around England, St Mary's, for example, how much does the FA pay for usage?
I suspect it's actually, to a certain extent, the other way round, that there will be a hosting fee paid by the clubs, because they want to demonstrate that they can host a match of that magnitude. It will be broadcast on TV, so they're getting publicity, and at the same time, they will get a proportion of the gate receipts, and that can actually work in the club's favour. So. Otherwise, the FA, I think, would be inclined to play more matches at Wembley or at St George's Park, or yeah, especially if the crowd's going to be low. So this gets the opportunity for fans around the country to see young England players, to see the Lionesses as well, all parties can win on the back of that. The club hosting the match now has an incentive to market the match which is taking place if they're on a proportion of the gate receipts, and the FA get to have England going around the country as well.
And presumably, apropos Nick Berg's question, Southampton, for example, are keeping the beer money, the pie money.
Yep.
And the programme as well. Okay. Yep. So is it, like you say, it's a win-win all around. Our next question comes from Matthew Millwood, which I'm so childish, I nearly didn't read this out because it sounds like Millwall. but Matthew Millwood has a question. And Kieran, I'm getting tearful. It's like welcoming back an old friend, this question. I genuinely didn't think there was any more questions to be had on the subject of the sale of Hillsborough Stadium. But Matthew's got one. Here it is. I apologise to everybody if I break down halfway through this. It's just a reminder of happier times when Sheffield Wednesday and Derby were all we had to speak about. Matthew says, in the period ending July 2019, There was a profit on the sale of Hillsborough Stadium of £38 million. There is now a lease for 30 years between the club and Sheffield 3, the new owner, with a value of £77.25 million. Am I right in thinking, then, that at the end of a 30-year lease, there will effectively be a loss of £37.25 million to the club, profit from the sale minus cost of lease, and who will then own the ground?
Right. I don't see that as being a loss to the club. Right. What has happened is that Hillsborough has been sold to ultimately this company, Sheffield 3, which is owned by the club owner, Delphon Chancery. Sheffield Wednesday Football Club are now the tenant. So they have a lease. They are paying rent from what I can make out of £1.5 million a year. And it's a bit like these, you see the adverts on daytime TV for equity release in your house. So effectively you sell your house, you get money, you then end up renting your house back from another company. And when you're no longer there, the house becomes theirs. So in terms of what happens at the end of the lease period, there's one of three things that could arise. First of all, Sheffield Wednesday would be in a position to buy back the ground at presumably the market price, or it could be a price which is already embedded into a contract. Secondly, they could renegotiate an extension on the lease for another X years, or Sheffield 3 could find a new tenant. But it's a single purpose property, so finding something else for it to be used for, I think, would be difficult. And there could be covenants to protect the use of Hillsborough as a football stadium embedded into that contract. We don't know. No. I mean, the whole reason behind the sale of Hillsborough was to address potential losses with regards to financial fair play, and they didn't work out. And on the back of that, ultimately, Sheffield Wednesday were relegated, as we know, which I'm not at ease with. Yeah, I've always said that what happens on the pitch dictates your final position in the table, rather than how good is your accountant or lawyer. So that's where we are. But they've certainly not suffered a loss. The reason why they raised a profit was that the value of Hillsborough had increased over the time of ownership of the property. Just if you arrive, we sold our house at a profit, it would be how much did we originally pay for it compared to the sale proceeds?
Yeah, I said 37.25 as a potential loss. It might be 39.25. I can't read my own writing. It's not even writing, it's numbers. And that will teach me to try and write the script at 8 o'clock last night after being in the Porson's Arms since 11 o'clock. it just strikes me, though, as well, Kieran. I was thinking about it this morning. Is in any other business, or certainly if you're selling a house or renting a shop, 30 years seems like a short lease. Would I be right in thinking that?
In the business world, no. So if you take a look at shopping centres, most of the retail units would be for 5, 6, 7 year leases. With a view to then some form of renewal, and if it's in both parties' interests, that is the case. There are certain accounting reasons why keeping it to 30 years might be beneficial, because that helps to allow the football club to register a profit. Otherwise, it might just be deemed to have been a loan from Sheffield 3.
Right.
The dark arts of accounting were arising, and I've got about 4 exam questions out of Hillsborough. From the way that it was done, because it's for me it's sort of lots of fun and games.
Oh, well, it's every cloud's got a silver lining, Kieran. I'm sure Sheffield Wednesday fans will be delighted to learn that there are 4 exam questions. Tom Ironside has a next question. Strong name, Tom Ironside. Last season, Manchester United appointed John Murtagh as a football director. It had long been said that the club needed one, but why? How does this one role separate the finance and the business from the football?
It doesn't necessarily separate them, it's more of a case of what happens when a manager leaves a club. You get a void, because historically we've had managers who ran the club for all of the football side of things, and if that manager goes, you've got all of a sudden a loss of continuity, and the role of a football director is that the length of tenure of a football director tends to be far longer than that of a manager. If we take a look at the Championship, for example, the average life expectancy of a Championship manager is 14 months, which is ridiculously short if you are looking at the strategy of a £40 or £50 million business. Mm. So the director of football acts as an intermediary, a buffer between the board of the manager. In theory, the manager is therefore just left to focus on match issues, on coaching, and the director of football can be involved in terms of the long-term strategy with issues such as the transfer policy. So the manager stroke coach, would he have involvement in the transfer policy? Yes, but will he be able to just go to the board and say, I want to sign X, Y, and Z, you go and sort it? It becomes a little bit more nuanced on that. The club would have another party who has football expertise, because otherwise you've got four or five businessmen. You've got a finance director, you've got a chief executive, you've got a HR director, a comms director, and so on. But in terms of their football qualifications, they might not have any between them. So you become over-reliant upon one individual. What happens if that he gets poached by another club or they decide to sack him? You bring somebody else in, and the first thing they want to do is to, I want to get rid of six players. I want to bring in six players I've worked with before. Yeah. And that becomes very expensive. So a director of football is very strategic. If you take a look at Manchester City and is it Cheeky Begiristain, he's very much involved in working alongside the manager, but dealing with the things that the manager really shouldn't be wasting their time on, such as negotiating contracts and trying to do the recruitment themselves.
Danny Murdoch. Hello, Danny. Says, my team, Inverness Caledonian Thistle, were in trouble in 2019, but some cost-cutting and fresh investment seemed to save things. The CEO, Scott Gardner, seems to be quite innovative, but COVID has hit us in more ways than one, as we had to cancel several concerts at our stadium. How perilous are our finances?
Danny's quite right. Inverness Cali Thistle were run pretty damn well. Between 2013 to 2016, they were making profits or breaking even, which is an achievement. And then things started to get worse. So they lost $400,000 in 2017. That doubled in 2018. That was around about the same in 2019. And the losses overall were mounting up. So there does appear to have been a change at the top with a view to running the club on more of a break-even model. The losses have been reduced by three quarters in 2020, despite the initial impact of COVID. So that's got to be encouraged. It looks as if there's been sort of an increase in terms of share capital to sort of bolster the balance sheet. So I would say that the right type of decisions, in my view, are starting to be made, and they were addressing some of the losses which were getting out of control. In terms of COVID, that's hit all clubs. Scottish clubs, from what I've seen, have dealt with this probably better than many clubs south of the border, because in the main they tended to be in a better financial position than English clubs. Although Cali Thistle, these losses were starting to make me a little bit twitchy.
Right, that's interesting, because you've always, since we first started doing this pod, you've always been more of a fan of the way Scottish football clubs manage themselves than English fans, English clubs, haven't you?
Yes, I mean, and it's sort of it's a double-edged sword, because what we have here in England is that we've got clubs who are very ambitious to get to the next level, because the rewards of promotion, especially if you go from League One to the Championship, Championship to the Premier League, are huge. What they have in Scottish football is a far more graduated and gentler slope between individual divisions, which means that there's less incentive to, you know, twist on 19, as I tend to describe it.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, if you're not prepared to gamble your house on getting from one division to another, then you're less likely to overspend. So, that's something I've been arguing with a lot of people. It's not that parachute payments are the problem. It's the gaps between the divisions are the problem. We're hoping to speak to Tracy Crouch this week as
we are.
I'll be interested to see her views. I don't know whether she's looked at Scottish football as well as the English game to see some of the benefits that they have up there.
Hopefully she has, because she was the minister for all of the country. That'll be a question for us to ask her. We have a long list of questions to ask Tracy, so I suspect that interview may go over two programmes, to be honest. Our next question comes from Ali MacArthur. Now, I'm not sure if this suggestion from Ali MacArthur is genius, out-of-the-box blue sky thinking, or proof positive that Ali MacArthur should not ever be allowed anywhere near running a football club. So I'm going to be interested to hear what you say about it, Kieran, because Ali says, I was wondering if, under the current climate, football clubs are looking for more inventive deals to entice players to join them. For example, would it be feasible to offer Kylian Mbappe a three-year contract at £600,000 a week, but pay it over 6 years at £300,000 a week? So even if he leaves after 3 years, he'd still be guaranteed that extra £300,000 a week for a further 3 years. And obviously, says Ali, it's a gamble, but is it an avenue to purchase players with bumper salaries? Now, I can see one issue, Kieran, which is if I was Kylian Mbappe, I'd wait a year and say, well, I've had a lovely time in Thornton Heath. And yes, Palace fans are Palace fans are great, but I'm off now. Use your bank details. Thank you. Goodbye. And sits back and gets £300,000 a year for 5 years. So is this genius or lunacy from Ali?
I think there is an element of genius here from Ali. I mean, this is all to do with cash flow management, and that's something which I am very keen on. This is something which I have.
Do you know what? You and Mrs. Day both. So let's not dwell too much on cash flow management.
I have similar conversations with the Baroness, who we have two different approaches to saving money. Hers is to go out and buy something and tell me how much money she saved because it was in a sale, and mine is to not buy something. I can't criticize. And I'd just like to have a quick shout out for Danny 29 from London, because it was the Baroness's birthday earlier last week. And I sort of a polite request to my chums in the media to let me have a day off, because I've genuinely worked every day this year, and they did. So I posted a picture of the wonderful Baroness, to which Danny 29 of London said, "She's a proper MILF." hashtag hot wife. And I then had the slightly awkward conversation with the Baroness, who didn't know what MILF or hot wife meant. And she went, oh. And I also had to point out that technically she's a GILF.
I can't begin to tell you how many things were wrong with what you just said there, Kieran. So the last thing you do is point out to your wife of many years standing that somebody has posted a comment about Lord. And also the fact that you, I love the your idea of saving money is to not spend it. You're living in a 70s sitcom, Kieran, you know that. You are slowly turning into Sid James.
Well, I'm a die a happy man if I could be Sid James.
Okay, let's get back to cash flow management then.
So back to Ali's question. Certainly, spreading a cost of a player does have benefits, and we are seeing this, of course, increasingly in terms of transfers. So could that be done with regards to players? Yes, it could. Yeah, the player could be on a monthly retainer, and then at the end of each year, they're given a loyalty bonus or an annual bonus, which helps the clubs, because the way that the Premier League works is that the Premier League's biggest payouts to clubs takes place at the start of every July. So yeah, they give you effectively a down payment of the following season's TV money. So yeah, that's really beneficial. So yeah, clubs could perhaps tie into that. That would help the club's cash flow. It would mean that they're going overdrawn less. If they're going overdrawn less, they're paying less interest in terms of loans. So yeah, there are merits to that. The alternative is to give Kylian Mbappe a hugely incentivized contract in terms of X, Y, and Z. Although when I was talking to an agent recently, he says sort of things such as goal contracts are diminishing simply because they found it's counterproductive. You know, players can actually become increasingly selfish. So win bonuses, yes. Individual goal bonuses, no. The reason why Spurs year in, year out, have the lowest wages to income ratio in the Premier League is that their pay scheme is very highly incentivized, and then they cunningly manage to not win any trophies, so they don't have to pay out the incentive payments, and that's why they got a very successful profit and loss account on the back of that. But yeah, there's certainly benefits. Whether the players would be in favour of that, and whether their representatives would be in favour of that, and the downside is, what happens if Kylian Mbappe leaves after 3 years? You've then got to pay him £300,000 a week for the next 3 years, plus his replacement on whatever he's coming in. So it can be a way of, short term gain, long term pain.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Do we have an age rating on this pod, Kieran? Because I'm just worried that, if we've got youngsters listening, all this MILF and GILF talk, especially as Guy is off this week, and rather sweetly, touchingly, and naively said, no one's around to edit it. Can you do one that doesn't need any editing?
Yeah, so, that doesn't need editing. That's fine. It's I think every teenage boy in the country probably knows.
Yeah, fair enough.
What's going on there?
Actually, and I've just realised Guy's not editing this. We can throw the word wrong and around with abandon.
We can.
We missed a trick there in the Rochdale thing, didn't we? We should have just referred to wrong and willy-nilly. There you go, willy-nilly. Ha-ha, take that out, Guy. You can't. Willy-nilly. I wonder if there's been anybody called willy-nilly. Anyway, I'm sure there was in Viz.
Yes.
Our next question comes from Colin Telford. And Colin says that Kieran has mentioned PLC football clubs a few times. That's quite right. And I share his view that they take football away from fans because ultimately the CEO of a PLC answers to shareholders whose interests may not align with supporters. But is there something to be said for PLCs in football. For example, do the disclosure and transparency rules provide protection against dun-da-da-da-da-da wrongins?
I think Colin raises a really interesting point here in the sense that you are less likely to have a PLC which is run as a personal fiefdom, although that can be done. Certainly, if we take a look at Manchester United, although it is a PLC and it is quoted on the New York Stock Exchange, because of the nature of the share ownership, where every share that is owned by the Glazers carries 10 votes compared to every share which is owned by anybody who has a surname which is not Glazer, their shares are only worth one vote each. It does allow them to effectively dictate policy. But there is increased scrutiny demanded by the stock exchanges. And that's why historically we've seen clubs such as Millwall, Sheffield United, Hearts and Spurs, who have been listed on stock exchanges, move away from that because the costs of complying with the demands of the stock market, on top of the fact that shareholders are saying, well, yeah, we don't care whether you win, lose or draw. We want a financial return. Meant that there was a genuine conflict in terms of sporting versus financial achievement. Colin does have, I think Colin's comments have some merits. What we have seen in respect of many wrong-uns and football is that these people have acquired what's best described as distressed assets. You know, football clubs who are in a parlous financial position and the owner sells to anybody just to get rid without doing too much due diligence. That's less likely to happen in a PLC environment. But if you're a small football club, you're not going to be a PLC anyway because you've got to be a certain de minimis size. And they're likely to be below the threshold. But more protection for smaller clubs is something we'd like to discuss with Tracy Crouch.
Of course. Ryan Thomas asks a really interesting question, and one which I know for a fact we've never talked about before. Ryan says, I was speaking to my sister the other day, who's looking to become a professional cricketer, and the subject of pregnancy came up, which as I was writing this semi-drunk last night at 8 o'clock, I found a little bit weird. Until I read the rest of the sentence, because I've just had a little boy. Congratulations, Ryan. That's wonderful news. Although we have such a backlog of questions, just in case, I should also say, happy third birthday, Ryan Jr. But this question is, Ryan's question is, and it's a really interesting one, do female footballers have pregnancy clauses in their contracts? Surely they can't go straight from a high wage to statutory maternity pay, and obviously they can't play while they're pregnant.
Well, I contacted Alex Colvin on this this morning. Alex is an ex-WSL player, and she's now an academic, and she's an absolute superstar as well. Yeah, I've worked with Alex on a few projects. She said that in general, there is no maternity cover or clause in terms of contracts, but there are a few nuances. So, for example, if you are an England player, then there is cover. But so that sounds, yeah, that sounds promising, progressive. You know, it gives protection to the player, of course. But England contracts are centrally negotiated, and they tend to be renewed annually. So, you know, whether you might have cover for a few months, and then they say, "Well, we're not going to renew your contract because you're either pregnant or you've just had a child, and as a consequence, we don't have plans for you in terms of playing for England for the next 12 months." So that could be a downside. So, but on a short term basis, that would benefit the players. The Football Players Union, FIFPro, does have a global policy in terms of maternity cover for female players, but Alex's research indicates that only 2% of players have taken up on this. But it's an ongoing issue, I think, from a player's perspective, because there's a lot of uncertainty. You know, that they want to progress their career, But they're not really getting a lot of information from the clubs. I think the clubs could do a lot better in respect of this particular issue by being proactive, by having meetings with the players and giving them a degree of certainty. But it's making progress, but it's slow progress on something which, in my opinion, could be dealt with quite easily and in an adult manner between all parties. So I think the clubs could do more here to give the players a little bit more comfort.
I have to say, Kieran, I'm actually genuinely surprised because I thought that the answer to the question, do female footballers have pregnancy clauses in their contract, was going to be yes, they do. So that's a surprise to me and an interesting one. But speaking of birthdays, Kieran, did the Baroness have a nice time? I saw a photograph of her dancing merrily on Brighton Pier at 12:30 in the morning, which is indicated that perhaps she did have a nice time. But
we had an absolutely wonderful time. We booked into a hotel. We went to her favorite restaurant, a place called the Ginger Man. We had the tasting menu there, and that went well. I mean, I had the water flight, which goes along with the tasting menu, nice. And the Baroness had the wine flight, and that probably would have gone reasonably well, but she'd had half a bottle of champagne and a couple of cocktails beforehand just to steady the nerves, and then I think the Nespresso martini at the end of the meal perhaps tipped her over the edge when she said, I now need more water, and then proceeded to pour a bottle of water over the table, which, okay, well, that's probably not the safety target. So then she thought it would be a great idea to go to the bandstand at Brighton Beach, and she says, oh, I don't want people to think I'm drinking. So she was merrily clutching a bottle of water there. Yeah, but it was a great evening, a wonderful time, and I'm very, very privileged to have her in my life.
Ah, oh, bless you. And although a true gentleman, Kieran, would have ordered the wine flight for himself just so the Baroness could have both.
But that could have got very messy.
I'm delighted to learn that, and I hope it's only in Brighton, that you get offered a choice of different water for each course. So I think you'll like this, sir. This is very robust tap water. Goes perfectly with the steak. Neil Palmer has a specific question about his local club, and we're always happy to talk about individual clubs. Neil says, I wondered if I could get your thoughts on my local club, Barnet. To me, the club's situation looks relatively bad in a league full of bad situations, and any investment in the club has all gone into the infrastructure, which is set up in a different company. I've got fond memories of Underhill, the old Barnet place. So I remember Palace playing there years ago in a pre-season friendly, and in particular, I remember the look on Attilio Lombardo's face as he walked onto the pitch, fresh out of Italian football. You thought my eyebrows went high. But it's seriously, he went, Lombardo walked out on the pitch and then went straight to a bloke in the stands who he assumed was his agent. You could see lots of Italian-style gesticulating. So even from where we were standing, it looked like he was saying, just check through my contract. Just check through all the smallest of corporate. There must be some way you can get me out of this country. Is Neil right to worry about Barnet?
Barnet Football Club actually runs quite well, in the sense that it appears to be breaking even from what I can make out. It is run by the AA Group, whose owner also appears to run some medical companies, which themselves seem to have done quite well. So from that point of view, the club appears to be okay. They don't own the stadium, as I think Neil was rightly pointing out, which does always make you slightly concerned, in terms of how long have we got the stadium for. But at present, I don't think things are too bad. Now, it could be that they're, but Barnet have been a classic yo-yo club between the EFL and the National League. And, again, a bit like you, I think my first trip to Underhill was, I think it was either 1981 or 1982, FA Cup third round, when Brighton were in the old First Division and they were non-league, and we scraped a 0-0 draw. We stunk the place out that day. And it was one of those matches you always remember, because I think Spurs and West Ham had kicked off at midday that day, and we were kicking off at 3 o'clock, and then Spurs and West Ham decided to have a, should we say, a meet-up in the car park after, you know, classic early 80s. Gentlemen, let's introduce ourselves to one another. So that was quite spectacular. So that was all 80s style fun and games, Green Street and all that. But in terms of their finances, I think their finances are okay. But what happens if the stadium is going to be, you know, lost is a cause of concern. And there have been issues in terms of the stadium because of movements and so on. I don't think that they're a club that is necessarily budgeting for a sustained attack to get back to the EFL. And I think that might form the part of Neil's concerns.
I also remember a couple of Barnet fans in the pub beforehand very patiently explaining to some leery South London lads that, yes, it had been pointed out before that Underhill sounds like somewhere that hobbits might live. Because, of course, everyone thinks they're the first one to say it. Hey, sounds like somewhere a hobbit would live, wouldn't it? Our final question comes from Tom Metcalf. Did I say you were living in a 70s sitcom?
That's right. It's actually my mate Grant, who's just popped round, who is a Palace fan, hasn't missed a Palace match for 9 years.
Oh, really?
Including pre-season friendlies. He's an absolute. But he came round last night, and he's left. I think he's left some stuff. So he's come to collect it.
Yeah, he's left some hopes and dreams. Finlay obviously likes him. At least Finlay's pleased to see him, isn't he? See, if this was a 70s sitcom, Sid James would be going, why is the dog so pleased to see him? Tom Metcalf has asked his question to both of us, which guarantees it being broadcast. I read it twice. I was like, you thought I welled up during the Hillsborough question. This really got me emotional. But Tom asked both of us, if you could make one change to football, what would it be? Well, obviously, personal level would be changing Palace's kit back to claret and blue. But it's a very tricky question, Kieran, with just one change. But for me, and I don't care how much Sky and BT pay for the rights, the one change I would make would be that the later the kickoff time, the closer the away team has to be. So Newcastle away at Wolves at 5:30 on the Saturday, just about doable. Newcastle away at Brighton, 8 o'clock kickoff, absolutely not, no way. So that would be my one change, although I was tempted by the idea that you always have about making stadia like listed buildings, but no, I'd go for that one. Home, you know, no ludicrous away journeys for football fans.
Yeah, I had sort of one for on the pitch, which is if a team is winning a match and it goes into the last 5 minutes and they are keeping the ball in the corner, yeah, towards the corner circle, you are legally allowed to kick them in the testicles up to three times to discourage them. Because I don't care whether we're winning or losing. It really hacks me. Like, how long do you see you play football? Not to fanny around in the corner area. So that would be my one for on the pitch. And off the pitch, actually, it's very similar to yours, Kevin. We have acquiesced to the TV companies and the football clubs for far too long with regards to changes to kickoff times. So the rule I would introduce is that if a kickoff time is changed for TV purposes, all season ticket holders would be entitled to, if they choose, to a refund on that particular match ticket. I've got tickets for concerts on Friday nights and Saturday. Yeah, you know, I might be doing something on a Saturday lunchtime. Yeah. I've got things. Yeah, you know, as you know, I work in Liverpool. Well, I commute from where I live to Liverpool normally on a Sunday afternoon under normal circumstances. So you wouldn't accept it on any other aspect of life. So why football clubs are allowed to get away with this? And we're just like nodding dogs. Yeah, yeah. I compare English fan culture to German fan culture. When they introduced or tried to introduce Monday night football, German fans said no, or nein, as it were. And you know, and they forced the German football authorities to back down. Why do we accept this nonsense? I sign up for Saturday at 3 o'clock. And if they want to change the match for football for TV purposes, if I can get to the match, then I will do my very best. But if due to circumstances I can't, well, you know, you failed to deliver Saturday at 3 o'clock, so give me my money back.
Yeah, well, that's a very good point. I think West Ham are playing Leicester, I think, on this Monday, tonight, in fact. Tomorrow night, this is Sunday, let's not get confused. So tomorrow night, West Ham are playing Leicester. And normally there would be West Ham fans and Leicester fans who have got young children who would happily go along to a Saturday 3 o'clock kickoff and now have to decide whether or not their kids are going to be late for school the next morning or tired for school. So yeah, that's a very good suggestion. I'd be interested actually. Let's ask our listeners for their one suggestion, one redoubtable suggestion for a change. We ask a lot of our support of our listeners, but I'd be interested because I imagine there'll be some really interesting ideas out there.
To be fair, they ask quite a lot of us as well. That's why we have to share on a Sunday.
That's a fair point. They demand a lot of us, Kieran. They demand upwards of 80 minutes a week of our time is what they demand. They demand us to crowbar the two 40-minute pods into our busy schedule. Also, don't forget, we have to source those sound effects that we pretend are really happening.
You know, yes.
We have to make sure that the barking dog sound effect is ready. And again, talking of asking you things, yes, if you do have suggestions for your one change to football, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com, which, of course, if you have questions as well, is the same address, questions@priceoffootball.com. And if you'd like to join the very many people who are making a small monthly contribution towards our always free-to-air podcast, then please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And as ever, thank you for listening. I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, thanks again, folks, for the feedback, and thanks for all the birthday messages that were sent. The Baroness was genuinely touched, and also the messages messages from Guy and Kevin. She was welling up when she saw all the stuff. So really appreciated. If you want to support the show, Patreon is one vehicle, and you know, for as little as £1 a month, that's great. But you don't have to do that if you don't feel so, or you don't, your circumstances dictate. But you can help the show by going on to the Apple Podcast button and following us there. And if you can give us a review, give us 5 stars. Doesn't matter what you say. Doesn't matter what you say. We love football the way it is. We don't want any rule changes. You know, that's fine. That's fine. But it does help the business, as we've said. We've got Tracy Crouch booked in for later this week, and you know, she wouldn't have come on the show unless she'd done a little bit of homework. She realizes that we do okay in the charts for a niche show, and it just helped keep us there in the public domain. So, but apart from that, thanks again for everything, and have a good week, and we'll see you on Thursday.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.